Hello, and welcome to MIT SHASS Radio, Environmental World Making. We're your hosts, Rebecca Lazzardi and Ariadne Dulcinos. In today's episode, we're going to dig deep into the 1970s North American metals mining industry. Be sure to stay tuned until the end, where we'll analyze the current day implications of mining, legislation, activism, and public health.
Metals mining has granted us some stellar technology. Brilliant jewelry, automotive parts, electronics, copper wire, even our satellites and NASA spacesuits are good as gold. Using extracted gold sheets to protect spacegoers from harsh, unfiltered sunlight. But in the mining industry, not everything has been crystal clear. There have been some rocky moments, and no, we're not just talking about the physical kind. Hold on to your pickaxe, we're going to the 70s.
Crested Butte, Colorado started out as a silver mining town in the early 20th century, and then, after a 10-year economic slump, was revitalized when a ski resort opened. Towering over Crested Butte is Mount Emmons, also referred to as the Red Lady by the residents of Crested Butte. Crested Butte held a mix of old-timers who had lived there all their lives and more recent residents that moved to the 1,000-person town with the hopes of a quiet life surrounded by nature. The economy and culture of the town largely depended upon its harmony with the surrounding mountains and valleys of Gunnison County. The international mining company AMAX had other plans for the area. It had found a 165 million-ton strike of the element molybdenum underneath Mount Emmons. Molybdenum is used primarily to strengthen steel alloys, so it's highly important in this industrial world. But the strike under Mount Emmons was only 0.44% moly, which means there would be around 150 million tons of waste after the 20 years of mining they planned to do. Many residents of Crested Butte immediately opposed the mining of Mount Emmons. They pointed out their town's reliance on the surrounding nature, Crested Butte's National Historic Designation, and the dangers of boomtown syndrome, where severe changes in population strain the resources of a town and lead to increased crime rates and unemployment. Crested Butte's residents were facing an enormous mining company, and United States law backed AMAX up. The U.S. Mining Act of 1872 allows mining companies to claim land for mining at little or no cost and without the consent of nearby communities. In 1977, AMAX officials said that they would not mine if the residents of Crested Butte didn't want them to. But once opposition began, they made it clear that there was no way the project would not be approved and begin promptly. They published a magazine, the Mount Emmons Report, that tried to persuade residents of mining's long, important history and that the mine wouldn't bring boomtown syndrome to Crested Butte. They even misquoted a Stanford professor as saying that AMAX's outstanding environmental concern was acceptable. AMAX was seen as a liberal mining company, performing social impact studies and promising programs for the town and reclamations for the mine waste. However, as Bob Wiley, the president of the nearby Rocky Mountain Biological Lab, said, the mine and mill sites may be recovered, but the tailings ponds, which hold the waste from mining, will be with us always, along with the impacts from the possibly temporary increase of several 100% population. Crested Butte's protests against AMAX received national attention, drawing support from celebrities like Robert Redford and receiving write-ups in publications like the New York Times. Because of the Mining Act of 1872, Crested Butte wasn't even required to have a seat at the discussion of the Mount Emmons mine. But the Forest Service, the Colorado Department of Natural Resources, and the Gunnison Board of County Commissioners ended up inviting Crested Butte officials to the discussions of the mines, and even began to develop a review process for mining. The fight between AMAX and Crested Butte remained in a stalemate for many years, with Crested Butte not backing down, even as AMAX built a water treatment plant for the proposed Mount Emmons mine. While many residents of the town fiercely opposed the mine, almost everyone saw it as inevitable. But as it turns out, it absolutely wasn't. In 1981, AMAX stopped the development of the mine, saying the economic recession had caused the demand for moly to go down. They said the mining was only delayed, but they never returned to mine Mount Emmons. The residents of Crested Butte saw this as a personal victory, since they had worked so hard to delay the mining and make their voices heard.
Thank you, Rebecca. Now we've examined an American case study. But it wouldn't be North America without Canada and Mexico, but that's another story for another podcast. In Canada, mining is hailed as a central industry, but the negatively affected communities, Indigenous Canadians, are understated by history due to their minority status. The first mining law, the colloquially known Free Entry Act, was passed in 1873 and lasted until the 21st century. The law did exactly what it sounds like, grant mining companies unlimited and exclusive access to extract metals from any tract of land. Yes, they prioritized access to some shiny rocks over the land's inhabitants, granting at most one day's notice to the current residents to evacuate the area for exploration to take place. Another infamous piece of legislation, which was a backdoor way for the government to suppress the Indigenous Canadians, was the 1969 White Paper Act, which granted them the illusion of citizenship at the cost of eliminating all their beneficiary social welfare programs and protections. Keeping this in mind, let's transport ourselves to the Beanland Gold and Silver Mine, founded by Goodfish Mining Company Limited in the 1930s in Temagami in the Ontario province. When Beanland was established, the Teme-Agama Anishinaabe Aborigines had been living on the land for centuries and used it for their trapping and hunting. The daily noises of gold and silver excavation startled wildlife that served as the Aborigines' food source, not to mention the clearing the land contributing to deforestation. After 40 years of tolerating the ruin of their land, the Teme-Agama Anishinaabe filed a land caution, a claim to stop industrial development on their lands. But unlike in Crested Butte, the Canadian Supreme Court refused to acknowledge the rights of the affected community, citing the 1850 Robinson Treaty, where upwards of 15 First Nations tribes unknowingly signed away their land to the Crown for a meager £2,160.
Sadly, the suppression of affected Indigenous communities by the government was not a one-time case. It's 1960s Ontario, and there's something fishy going on at Grassy Narrows Reserves, home to members of the Ojibwe First Nation. The Reed Paper Company dumped toxic mercurial waste into the Wabagoon River, the primary source of fish, a staple food for the residents. This results in most of the fish being poisoned with severe levels of mercury, enough to poison humans. With mercury poisoning, you don't see it until it's too late. It's famously first detected from the dancing cat. No, not some cute cat jamming out straight out of a meme. We're talking fatal muscle spasms after eating the poisoned fish. After the cats, the Indigenous people began to get sick and succumb to the mercury. The Canadian government refused to take the plight seriously. Instead, they chose to hide what happened by invalidating autopsy reports and keeping reports by scientists quiet. What's more, the shameless self-promo moment when the Canadian Trade Minister expressed interest in exporting these fish abroad for commercial consumption, mercury included. Of course, this was after they shut down commercial fishing by Grassy Narrows residents without providing economic relief. Who's down for some fish and chips? It's now been 60 years since the Reed Paper Company poured mercury into the Wabagoon River, and the Canadian government this year has finally funded treatment centers for the residents who still suffer from mercury poisoning. But the consequences of the mercury contamination aren't going away anytime soon.
I know what you may be thinking. Whoa, 1970s North American metals mining really did get rocky. Isn't there some sort of silver lining? Although creating a safer and more inclusive industry that is fair for all parties is still a work in progress, the outlook is getting brighter every day.
In 2009, Canadian law amended the Free Entry Act so that a mining claim may not be staked on reserve lands, except as provided by the Indian Lands Act of 1924. Indigenous Canadians continue to fight for progress to be made such that no claims may be staked on their land, period. The Teme-Agama Anishinaabe continue to operate actively and have formed a governing council of Chief Randy Becker, Second Chief John Turner, and several councillors.
This year, a federal judge mandated the environmental review of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which spans multiple states.
One significant victory in the journey to Indigenous justice came in 2014, when the Silcotin won a Canadian Supreme Court case to get official recognition of Aboriginal land titles.
If you want to get involved with advocating for Indigenous justice, some organizations to watch for are the International Workgroup for Indigenous Affairs, IWGIA.org, CulturalSurvival.org, and Reconciliation Canada. If you want to help combat infringatory mining operations in communities, support Earthworks and Sierra Club. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and that you learned some new information about the mining industry and Indigenous justice. Tune in next time on MIT Shass Radio.
And sing and dance and shout and tell them bye-bye, Amex, bye-bye. Bye-bye, Amex, don't cry. All we can say is golly, we're sorry about the bottom just dropped out of Molly. Bye-bye, grill rigs are shucks. Bye-bye to all the trucks. We wish we could say we'd like you to stay. But all we know is that we're